Do you have a friend? A good friend? A person that if you were climbing a mountain, you would want them beside you. You know, in my life of about 42 years now, there are some people that I say, you know, that person is one of the people I would want on my team. And you say, well, I mean, your team to do what? Doesn't matter. If I am in the middle of a war zone battle, I want that person standing beside me. If I'm in the middle of a debate and I am needing somebody to help me prepare for that, I want them there with me. If I'm in the middle of a lake and my boat has just sunk, I want them, well, you almost wish your friends weren't there so they wouldn't be in the middle of the lake with you, but you would still want them there. Because you've got a number of very real, very profound ideas in the Bible about friendship. You were put here to work together with other people. In fact, the one thing after God creates the world, there's one thing that's not good. He creates Adam, blows into him the breath of life. And then after everything is good, God says there's one thing that's not. It is not good that man should be alone. Because you are designed to work together with friends. And so, what we're going to be discussing in this particular session is how to have good friends and how important they are. Because when you get to the end of your life, or when you get to where you seriously are calculating the things in your life that are the most absolute valuable things that you have ever had, you will start thinking about your friends if you've made good friend choices. If you don't make good friend choices, well, that's a different story, and we'll get into that too. If you were to look in Proverbs chapter 17, verse 17, you would read a very simple statement. A friend loves at all times, and a brother is born for adversity. A friend loves at all times, and a brother is born for hard times. Now, here's the thing about friendship. It's very interesting in that it's unlike other relationships that you've got in your life. I've kind of divided relationships into three categories. You've got the category of involuntary and permanent relationships. An involuntary and a permanent relationship is one you didn't get to pick, and it'll never be any different. Now, you guys could tell me some involuntary permanent relationships. A child to a parent is an involuntary permanent relationship. This is my son, Reed. Reed, stand up right here. Pat, come here, Reed. Come here. This is Reed. Reed hates attention. Actually, he abhors it. He just can't stand attention. Okay, now Reed is going to be my son, whether he likes it or not, for the rest of his life. I'm sorry, Reed, but it does get you in the hospitality room over the course of this weekend, and he hasn't been minding that. Notice the plate. Thank you, Reed. Now, it doesn't matter what Reed does, he's stuck as my son. And there are some things that come along with being my son that he's got to do that are commanded to him by God. Ephesians chapter 6, verses 1 through 3. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with promise. He's got to do that. If he's going to follow the correct, God-given, moral path of life, he's got to act in a certain way toward people who are involuntary, permanent relationships. You don't get to pick those. You just have them. As you have your children, there will always be your children. You don't ever change that. And so, you have responsibilities to those types of relationships. Now, there's another type of relationship that is a voluntary permanent relationship. Marriage is a voluntary permanent relationship. It's something that you get to choose whether you're going to do or not. But once you choose it, it is then permanent. And it should be that it never changes until death. And as you look at the instructions that God has given us, they're in Matthew chapter 19:9, and the Pharisees have come to Jesus and say, can you divorce a woman for just any reason? And Jesus takes them back to the garden and says, from the beginning it was not so, but God created him male and female. And for this reason, he said, a man shall leave his father and mother and shall cling to his wife, and the two shall be flesh. And what God has joined together, let no man separate. Okay, it's a permanent relationship. You get to pick it. But once you pick it, you are in it for life. And it doesn't matter if in the course of after being married, things arise that you're there. Now, friendship is different. Friendship is a voluntary, not permanent relationship. That means you pick it and you can leave the friendship at any time. Now, there are some of us that think, well, you know, once I pick somebody who's my friend, then I need to be in that relationship for the whole time. Okay, no, that's not necessarily true. Because if in the course of your friendship, you see that something has changed in another person and causes them to not be the kind of influence that you need in your life, then you get yourself out of that relationship. And so here's what you've got going with friendship. You get to pick it and you get to decide how long you're going to stay in it. And it's a unique relationship in that that's something that you don't get to do with every other relationship. Now, as you're starting to pick your friends, you look at Proverbs 17:17, and it says, a friend loves at all times, and a brother is born for adversity. Now, the first thing that you need to ask yourself when you're thinking about friends is, will this person stick by me when I need help? You know, because one of the main reasons that you have friends is because when you get in times where you need assistance and help, your friends are there. If you go to Ecclesiastes chapter 4, you look at verse 10 and following, it says that two are better than one. And the reason that two are better than one is because if one person falls down, if you're climbing Mount Everest by yourself and you slip, you just keep on sliding. But if you're climbing Mount Everest by yourself and you're tied to somebody else who has an axe pick and some good pointy toe boots that are stuck in the ice, when you slide, that friend holds on to you and you don't slide down to your death. You get caught and are able to continue your climb. So when you're picking friends, you've got to ask yourself the question, will this person be there when I need help? Because, you know, there are a lot of people who would say they're your friend, but they wouldn't be there when you needed help. As I look over the course of my life and I think about standing together with your friends, people who have helped you over the course of your life, there's a friend of mine right now, his name is Stephen Bersenio. Stephen Bersenio came to my house probably when we were 15. He started spending a couple nights at our house a week, and then about three nights a week at our house, and then about four nights a week at our house. And probably by the time we graduated from high school, he was staying at our house most every night, and once or twice a month he would go spend the night somewhere else. But he was with us and had been my friend for years and years. Went to college with me at Freed Hardeman. He was one of my roommates. I came back from a class one afternoon and I said, man, my side is hurting. And I was laying on my couch and my side was really, it was like I had a bad, bad stomach ache, but it was very different than just a regular stomach. I don't know what it was, but it just hurt really bad. And I was laying on my couch and Steve said, are you all right? I said, yeah, I'll probably be fine. I just need to take a nap, I think. And so I was laying on this old green couch. I think we picked it up on the side of the road. It was the bed that I slept on for about a year and a half in college in this old house at Freed Hardeman. But I laid down on that couch and he said, I think you need some help. I said, no, I don't need any help. Look, I'll just take a nap right here. So I laid down and he said, no, you need help. Something is not right with you. And I said, no, Stephen, it's fine. I'm not hurt. It's nothing. I wake up in the hospital 2 hours away in Columbia, Tennessee, having had an appendectomy because my appendix almost ruptured in the 2 hours that it took to drive from Freed Hardeman to Columbia, Tennessee. Now, if Stephen had not loaded me in my truck and driven me back to Columbia, Tennessee, there is a good chance that I would have had a much more complicated recovery because my appendix had almost busted. And if your appendix busts, you get all kinds of junk in your abdomen and it's a whole lot worse than if they just go in and clip it off and sew it. Now, I told Stephen, I was like, hey, man, I'm fine. I don't need to go anywhere. I'm fine. And he said, no, something is wrong with you. And insisted that he drive me to the hospital, and he did. Now, Stephen and I are still best friends. We just finished playing golf Sunday, and we still hang out. And Stephen has been my friend since I was 15 years old at Short Mountain Bible Camp when we started playing doubles volleyball. And since we were 15 at Short Mountain, we have been best friends for the last 28 years or so. Now, I say that to say, sometimes you think that, you know, a friendship, somebody you meet at camp, somebody that you meet at school or at church, and they're your friends, well, you know, it's just friendship. But in a lot of ways, friendship can physically save your life. But then in another lot of ways, friendship can spiritually save your life. Because it's one thing for a friend to say, hey, I'm going to drive you to the hospital and make sure that you don't, your appendix doesn't blow up and you don't die. But then when it comes to times where you need a friend in a spiritual situation who will be there for you to help you, do you have those kind of friends? Because a friend loves at all times. And a brother is born for adversity, the times of trouble. You know, maybe even a better question is not do you have a friend like that, but are you a friend like that? A friend who, when there is trouble, you will stand beside your friend no matter what. You know, because sometimes you think you've got friends. But when the rubber meets the road and things get kind of hard and things get tough, those friends, they're not there for you. I was talking to a minister on the campus of UNA, University of North Alabama, and he was the college minister. And at this particular university, it's a pretty big university. I think it's the 10th largest in the state of Alabama. And this particular college ministry is thriving. They probably have 100, 150 kids that come to the Christian Student Center there and have Bible studies all the time. Really strong set of people, and the church there in this group is respected, and they're a good group. But he said this one girl who was working there with the Student Center, There's a professor on the campus that delights in causing young people to question their faith. In fact, as I understand it, the young people, the college people will come in to the as a freshman, and he will make them stand up and say, is there anybody in here who believes in God? And if you do, stand up. And he'll force them to stand up, and then he will say, by the end of this semester, you will not believe in God anymore. I'm going to show you that that's a ridiculous idea, that there's no evidence for that, and your faith in God is something that you have kept on holding to from the time you were, but it's nothing that is rational, and I'm going to show that to you. So, this particular young lady was in that class, and the professor said, okay, if you believe in God, stand up. And she did. But she looked around and saw a bunch of the other kids from the Christian Student Center that she knew identified as Christians. And they didn't stand up. And she came back to the minister of the Christian Student Center there, and he said she was just furious. And I was expecting her to be angry at the professor. And he said she wasn't angry at the professor because that's what you expect from an atheistic professor. A person who doesn't believe in God and who's not out for your best interest. And that's what you expect. And she was ready for that. She said, though, but what broke her heart was she knew that there were other people there in that classroom that thought the way she thought. And she thought she could count on them. But she couldn't. They wouldn't stand with her. You know, when the Founding Fathers were deciding whether or not they were going to sign the Declaration of Independence. What they were doing when they put their name on that piece of paper was committing high treason. Now, under a monarchy system where the king is the ultimate ruler and you commit treason, what is the punishment for committing treason? Now, we think about it as just kind of political, and now what over 200 years removed from the situation, we almost glamorize it like they knew that they were going to win the war and they knew that they were going to start a nation. And we look at it like, okay, when they were basically just a small group of individuals huddled up asking themselves, were they ready to make this step, to take this leap? They knew that if they signed their name to the Declaration of Independence and they lost the battle, and the king was reinstated as the leader of the colonies, that anybody who had signed their name to the Declaration of Independence was public enemy number one and would be killed. And Benjamin Franklin, knowing the severity of what would happen to them, said to the group who was signing the Declaration of Independence, he said, "Gentlemen, we must all hang together in this, or you can know that we will all hang separately." Now he said, if you're ready to sign your name to this, then you have to be totally committed, because if you are not totally committed to this, then this effort will fall apart and we will all die unless we stick together throughout the whole process. And so as you're looking at that idea of a friend loving at all times, are you the kind of friend that is a person who says, I will be there for you? And are your friends the ones who will stand beside you if you were having to stand up in a freshman class against a professor who was trying to bully you out of your faith? And so what you're trying to do is you're trying to pick those kinds of friends. Now here's the beauty of friendship. You get to pick them. The Proverbs writer says, a wise man chooses his friends carefully. Now, what I've seen is that lots of times we don't choose our friends carefully. You know, the friends that we pick, normally we pick the friends who pick us. Or, now this is the number one reason that I have seen teenagers pick a friend. Somebody tell me the number one reason why teenagers say they like a person. I like that person because, do you know what answer I've gotten the most often? Because what? Because he's funny. That's the number one answer. Okay, I like this person because when I'm with him, I laugh and I have fun, and that dude is hilarious. That girl is so funny. She is loud and funny, and I like hanging out with her because she's funny. Okay, now let me ask you a question. On a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being the most valuable attributes of something that can help you succeed spiritually in life, where does he or she is funny land on that scale of 1 to 10? You know, but it's just easier to be around somebody who's funny. It's just easier to hang out with somebody who's hilarious. Is being funny a good way to decide who your best friends are going to be? It's not. But it is a way that many of us do decide, because, now, here's the second thing. Man, I'm friends with that person because they're real easy to be around. Okay? I mean, it might be that you've got some people that are easy to be around, but does easy to be around necessarily mean, hey, that person's going to help you? No, and that's why the Bible says that a wise man, now listen to it close, chooses his friends carefully. You decide, will this person stand beside me? Does this person stand for things that I can stand beside them? So the first thing, as you're looking at it, is a friend will help you in times of trouble. Now, when you sing the song, there's not a friend like the lowly Jesus. No, not one. No, not one. Do you believe Jesus would help you in a time of trouble? You know, every characteristic that you have of friendship, if you apply it to Jesus, you recognize that He's the ultimate friend. He's the friend that not only would stand beside you in a time of trouble, but would stand up for you when others would try to beat you down. Jesus is the ultimate friend. And so you look at those kind of characteristics and you apply them to other people. Would they stand beside you like Jesus would? And, you know, I think of some other times when I had a friend who helped me, who was there for me when I was in trouble. I remember being at Fried Hardeman, and, you know, I guess a lot of this stuff happened years ago. I had a friend named Josh Ketchum. Josh Ketchum drove at the time it was a big white diesel Chevrolet extended cab, and I had a 1986 and a half Nissan. Now, there's a reason that 86 and a half is important. Now, you might not understand the reason for it, but I had a 1986 and a half Nissan extended cab SE V6 truck that had it was maroon and silver. It was affectionately named the Maroon Marauder. And we called it the Maroon Marauder because I would take this vehicle anywhere that anybody would take a four-wheel drive because it had a very light back end. The V6 engine in it was pretty heavy, and the very first night I got it, my dad said, "Hey, here's your truck." He gave me my new, it was January 1st, and I was going to December 31st, I was going to a New Year's party, and he handed me the keys and the payment book and said, "Here's your new truck, here's the payments." And I remember the payments were like $225 each month. And he said, "Here's your new truck." I wrecked it the first night I had it. And from that moment on, and here's why, I was going, it was raining, I was going to a fork in the road, and I turned, and the back end was real light. And the front end had a pretty good size for a little truck that it wasn't, so the back end just swung around, hit a stop sign the very first night I had it. So from then on, I just thought, I can run this thing into anything. Because if you wreck it the first night you get it, then you just wreck it. And so I would. I ran it into mailboxes. I ran it into hay bales. I ran it into everything. And the way that you can make a two-wheel drive act like a four-wheel drive is just go faster over the stuff. Because if it's light enough, then it'll just go over. So just don't stop giving it gas. And my buddies from high school, their motto, they were motorbike drivers, and it was, "When in doubt, gas it." And I thought, that's a great life strategy when you're driving an SE V6 1986 and a half truck. Now, here's the reason that it's important, because 1986 and a half, that makes it a hard body. Nissan's put out a truck called a hard body, which meant when you hit it with a hammer, then the only place it would dent was right there where you hit it with a hammer. It didn't dent the rest of the side. It didn't do anything. Only that one place where you hit it. It was very solid metal, which was a good thing. So me and Josh Ketchum, and there's something else that I've always been deficient at all my whole life. Directions. I never know where I am. The GPS has saved my life because I get lost all the time. I never know where I am because most of the time I'm thinking about something in my head instead of the building that I just passed. And so I grew up in Columbia, Tennessee, and my dad will say, "Hey, Kyle, you know it's that building that we've passed for the last 12 years?" And I'll say, I don't know the building, no, sir. And he's amazed at that because he can't believe I've never seen the building. Now, I will then incidentally say to him, "Dad, do you hear the words on this song that you listen to? That'll have a country song on, and it'll have all kinds of stuff in it that will not be something that is good." And I'll say, "Dad, do you hear what this song is saying?" He'll say, "No, what are you talking about?" And I'll say, "Do you listen to the words of songs?" He says, "No, I never hear the words of any songs." I said, "You listen to this song and don't ever hear the words to the song." Now, when a song comes on, I hear every word. I'm a word person. I hear every word of every song. And in fact, my kids just tell me, "Don't tell me the lyrics to the songs because we don't want to know them, because half the time we don't know the words. Just, we don't hear the words." My dad can have listened to a song 30 times and never heard the words. Because he's thinking about, okay, you turn right here at this building. Well, when the song comes on, I'm thinking about the words. That's incidental to the point of, we're driving at Tixaw in Fried Hardman University, and we've got a 12 o'clock curfew. I've got my little truck. I jump over a hill, get airborne, and land on a little island where my wheels are not touching the ground at all, but a large mound of dirt is impaled on the frame of my truck. Okay, it's going nowhere. You can't push it. You can't do anything. It's 11:45, curfew's at 12. Me and Josh had said, we were driving these trails, me and Josh had said, hey, we'll meet you back at the dorm at 12. Chickasaw is 20 miles out, and it's almost 12 o'clock, and I am in the middle of, I have no idea where, and to walk anywhere, to walk to a house is going to take me 3 hours. Easy. And I'm thinking, I don't know what I'm going to do. So I get out of my truck, I get my knife and I get my flashlight, my mag light. This is back and forth good LED lights. Get my mag light and my knife I had in my truck. And I start walking. And I think it's going to be 5 o'clock before I get anywhere. Well, I'm walking for about 15 minutes. And now I don't know how you could, the trails, there's no markings, there's no signs, there's no nothing. And about 15 minutes after I start walking, I see these headlights up front coming at me. Josh pulls up in his big white truck. Here's what he says. He said, man, I knew you would get lost up in here. He said, because your sense of direction is terrible. And I thought, I've got to go back and get Kyle because he's somewhere in Chickasaw and he's not making it back tonight. Now, when he said that, I thought to myself, what a friend. I was going to be late for curfew, and if you're late, there's all kinds of little stuff you have to do. He didn't have to be late. We had already agreed we'd meet back at the dorm, but he knew me so well that he thought, dude's never making it back. I got to go get him. Are you the kind of friend that goes and gets the person you think might be left? Do you have a friend that they would sacrifice their every one of their 60 late minutes they get for the whole semester and come pick you up because they know you so well, they know you're not making it back that night because your sense of direction is terrible? Well, a friend loves at all times, and a brother is born for adversity. But you know, there's something else about friends, too. Yes, friends help you if you get the right friends. What happens when you get the wrong ones? What happens when you choose poor friends? If you were to look in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, and you're looking about verse 33, the Bible explains to you that evil companions, bad friends, what happens with bad friends?
They help you get into trouble instead of out of trouble.
They help you get into trouble. You know why? Because they're not looking out for your best interest. They want to have fun. They want to do something exciting. I want you to turn to Galatians chapter 2. And in Galatians chapter 2, you're going to read a story that I think is one of the most unique in all of the New Testament. I want to ask you who was probably the most recognized leader in the early church, starting with Acts chapter 2. You would well know that for the first, nine chapters or so of the book of Acts, you've got Peter, who stands up on the day of Pentecost. He preaches the first recorded gospel sermon. He is recognized as one of, if not the, paramount leaders in the New Testament church. And then there's a guy who the apostles recognize as a son of encouragement. In fact, that's kind of what they name him, Barnabas, meaning the son of encouragement. And Barnabas hears later about this guy by the name of Paul. And nobody will let Paul into the inner church circle because they think that Paul's trying to kill them all. And Barnabas is the one who goes and gets Paul, brings him into the inner circle of the church. Now, here's what's interesting about the situation in Galatians chapter 2. Maybe you'll remember that Peter was called to go to preach the gospel to the Gentiles for the first time officially after the church was started. And Peter didn't want to go. In fact, Peter, as what he thought a good Jew ought to be, he was very separate from the Gentiles. And maybe you'll remember he was up on top of that rooftop and he had this vision of this huge sheet being let down. And when the sheet was spread out, there were a bunch of unclean animals. Like a buzzard. Imagine this. You're you, and all you've ever thought was, I don't touch the carcasses of unclean animals. I don't touch unclean animals. I only eat clean animals like cows and sheep and goats, etc. And this sheet full of unclean animals like pigs and buzzards and various sundry stuff that in your whole life, not only did you not eat, but if you saw them on the side of the road dead, you would make a wide arc to make sure you didn't touch them. And a voice comes out of heaven. God says, Peter, arise and eat. Go kill a buzzard and eat it. What's your reaction to go kill a buzzard and eat it? You know, I don't know what unclean animals were in the sheet, but a buzzard was in the list of unclean. Pigs were in the list of unclean. You named several other ones. Okay, so you're looking at that thinking, not only do I not want to eat a buzzard, I don't want to touch a buzzard. And we've got rules about that stuff. We as a Jewish nation have these rules in Leviticus chapter 11 about the animals we can and cannot eat. Buzzard is off the list. Well, the sheet gets taken back up into the heavens again. It comes back down. Rise, Peter, kill and eat. And Peter answers, not so, Lord. I've never eaten anything unclean. Now, this was to prep Peter for the messengers that were coming from Cornelius' house, who was the first Gentile convert. Basically the first official one. And they invite Peter to come, and he realizes, okay, that vision was for me to recognize that other people are not unclean. So he shows up to Cornelius' house. He's invited all of his family, and Peter basically, almost, it looks kind of rude the way he responds to Cornelius. I don't know if it was, but in the interaction, he says, why'd you call me up here? What am I doing here? And Cornelius explains that an angel had come to him and said, send these people to this house in Joppa, bring Peter. And then Peter says, of a truth, I perceive that God is no respecter of person. God doesn't show partiality. Okay, I have seen the light. I realize that these new converts, after he preaches the gospel to them, he baptizes them into Christ, the first Gentile conversion officially into the church, he says, all right, I see that God loves everybody. So who is the bridge maker, it looks like, between the Jewish people and the Gentiles? Peter. He's the one that, in fact, he goes back in Acts chapter 15, and a lot of the Jews accost him, and they say, Peter, heard you went to those Gentiles. What's up with that, buddy? And he says, let me tell you what happened. God sent me this vision, and then they received the miraculous gifts of the Holy Spirit. Who was I to fight against God? I'm just doing what God says. And so they say, I guess you're all right. I guess you got it right. So Peter is the one who welcomes the Gentiles into the church. Barnabas is the one who welcomes Paul into the church, and Paul becomes the apostle to the Gentiles. And then you're in Galatians chapter 2, you start in verse 11. Now when Peter came to Antioch, the text says, I withstood him to his face because he was to be blamed. For before certain men came from James in Jerusalem, he would eat with the Gentiles. But when they came, he withdrew and separated himself, and even Barnabas was carried away with their hypocrisy. So what's going on here? Peter is there at this congregation with the Gentiles, and they are getting along great, and he's eating with the Gentiles, and he's welcoming them as his brethren, as members of the Lord's church, just as full-fledged as he is. And there are certain people who come from James in Jerusalem, and they get there and they say, Peter, are you eating with the Gentiles? Now, these are Peter's friends. These are members of the church. These are Christians. But they're questioning whether or not the church is really for everybody. And Peter was having a great time with the Gentiles before they show up. But when they show up, they bring racism into the situation that wasn't there before. And they say, Peter, are you really going to eat with these Gentiles? And Peter starts looking at his friends, the Gentiles, his buddies, who he's been eating with and having a great time in full fellowship with. And then he starts looking at these Jerusalem friends over here who are trying to persuade him not to have a part in this Gentile church stuff. At least not publicly while you eat with them. And you know what he says to the Gentiles in essence? I'm just eating with the Jews from now on. And then Barnabas, who went and got Paul and introduced him to the church, who is the son of encouragement. And I think it's very interesting that Paul here in Galatians says, even Barnabas was carried away with their hypocrisy. You know, there are some people that you would think would stand up for their Gentile brethren. But Barnabas wouldn't. And so Peter and Barnabas and all the uppity Jewish Christians are now over here and they're eating with each other and they're leaving the Gentiles over there and the Gentiles are looking at Peter and Barnabas and the other elite Jewish Christians thinking, I thought this church was for everybody. And now they're making it out like it's a Jewish sect that's only really to stay separated. And so into this scene comes the Gentile's friend, Paul. Now, I would love to see how this went down. But everybody looking at Peter as the leader of the church, and it looks like to me that somehow in a very, very public way, Paul says, I withstood him to his face in front of them all. Can you imagine that? Now, I don't know who you would, in this community, the two people you would say, and just I don't know who you would say the two leaders of the church in Paintsville or wherever it was. Maybe it was in Nashville, whatever. Can you imagine two people that were very respected as leaders of the church, maybe on a Sunday morning here in Paintsville, everybody's mingling around or whatever, and they are standing up at the front, and one of them raises his voice to the other one and looks at him and says, you're sinning, and you need to quit. Because you used to eat with these Gentiles, and when these Jewish friends of yours came, you quit eating with the Gentiles, and that's wrong. Can you imagine the stir that that would make? That the two leaders of the church standing in front of everybody, and one of them just dressing down the other one because he's quit fellowshipping with the Gentiles that he should have been fellowshipping with the whole time, but he got carried away with his Jewish Christian friends. You know, friends are great to have when they're helping you and you stand together in what's right. But a lot of times those friends will lead you in the wrong direction. Wasn't it wonderful that Paul was friend enough to Peter to stand up for him and to him in a situation like that? Now, I remember years ago, there was a guy who was in Montgomery, Alabama. He was homeless. He lived in the back of the U-Haul trailer that was parked at the car wash a block down from our offices at Apollo Express. And he would sit with three or four other people that were homeless or they were skipping school or whatever on the concrete picnic table right outside of our offices. And I saw him sitting out there periodically quite a bit. And so one day I just decided I'm going to go out there and talk to him and see what they're up to. And so sat down, ate lunch with him one day, and started just asking their names. This guy's name was Jason, and he was dating this girl who lived in an apartment right next to our offices, and he didn't go to school, and this other guy was supposed to be going to school, but he wasn't either. And so there were about five or six of these guys that were basically had nothing to do but hang out and get in trouble. And that's what they did. He was at the wrong place at the wrong time and was accused of something, got thrown in the county jail, and was in there for, I think, about 8 months. Now, another guy got accused of the exact same thing with him, was thrown in the county jail, but bail was $1,800. His parents bailed him out, but Jason had no parents, had no family connections at all, and because he didn't have $1,800, stayed in the county jail for 8 months. Well, best thing that ever happened to him. Because in the course of that time, we started studying the Bible. I visited him a time or two and said, hey, you want to study the Bible? He said, yeah, it'd be great. So I think every Tuesday and Thursday I would go for an hour. And it was like the TV scene where you got the plexiglass and you had the phone and you had to talk through your phone. And he would have his phone on the other side and he'd bring his Bible and we'd study. And so we continued to study. First time, we think, in Montgomery County jail history they let him out to baptize him at the Eastern Meadows Church of Christ, and this was probably when I was 26 years old or so. So he's baptized in his orange jumpsuit and handcuffs there at the congregation with you know, people there on either side of him making sure he didn't try to make a break for it. So he becomes a Christian, and he's got another 2 months in jail. So we keep studying. And I say to him, Jason, when you get out, what's the one thing that you've got to make sure that happens? You surround yourself with people who are trying to go where you're trying to go. You're trying to go to heaven, and you need to focus on where you're trying to go. And so he gets out, and we try to help him. The congregation there and several people had met him and knew about him, and so they help him get a little bitty apartment and try to help him get a job. And so for several weeks, he's doing pretty good. And then I think I was supposed to maybe take him to a Wednesday night Bible study, or he was supposed to go, and he didn't show up. And I contacted next day, and said, Jason, where were you? Well, a couple of friends stopped by. I said, you know, who are they? Well, you know, so-and-so who we knew back before I went to jail. They're back in the neighborhood, and they stopped by, and they came over and stayed till 3 or 4, and I just couldn't go Wednesday. But I'll be there next Wednesday. I said, okay, Jason, you remember the discussion we had about friendship? He said, oh, yeah, yeah. In fact, he said, I've been thinking we really need to get these guys into the Word, and we need to really start studying with them and getting them to know the Bible. I said, that's great to make sure you care about their souls, but just understand that if you align yourself as a close friend to somebody who's not going the direction you're going, pretty soon you won't be going that direction. He said, no. He said, I know what I'm doing. He said, I'm totally converted. I'm totally in with Jesus. And all I'm spending time with these people is just to help them become Christians. You know where that's going, don't you? Within 6 months, Jason had completely stopped going to any type of church services. Jason totally cut off any communication with any of his church friends that he had met over the course of the 8 months that we had been studying and trying to get him in contact with Christians and people. And Jason hadn't heard from him since, because he decided that he would choose friends who weren't going the direction that he was going. You see, friendship is a voluntary, chosen relationship that, if you choose wrongly, is one of the most devastating relationships that you can ever get in, and can be one of the most destructive and painful. But if you choose correctly, you choose people like Daryl Pickle. You choose people like Lonnie Jones. You choose people like Josh Ketchum, Eric Lyons, Chad Thompson, the people that, of all the people that I have seen in the course of my life, if you will choose people that have a spiritual personality of something that you wish you had, that person is a wise, quiet person, and I talk way too much. I'd sure like to be more like that person. I'm going to become a friend to that person, and I'm going to be friends with that person. That person is a studious, biblical thinker, and they make decisions based on what the Bible says. I've always wanted to do that. I'm going to find that kind of person. That kind of person is the one who stands up for the truth, and I want to be braver and stronger. I want to be like that person. I'm going to connect myself to that person, and I'm going to be friends with that person. You see, a wise person, listen to the text, chooses his friends carefully. You choose your friends. And you choose how long you want to be with that group of people and that person. And if they're going a direction that you know you shouldn't go, then you can choose to stop that. And as you think about the great friendships over the years, you think about the disciple that Jesus loved, John. Throughout the course of Jesus' life, Jesus being the best ultimate friend who was always there for everybody, and John, the disciple who Jesus loved, in the inner circle of Jesus' friends, Jesus spent 3 years of his life here on this earth, picking his apostles. He picked them. And then Mount of Transfiguration, who's he take? Peter, James, and John. The inner circle in the garden, who's he take? Peter, James, and John. All through the course of the Gospels, you read about Peter, James, and John. John being the disciple that Jesus loved. And who was the one apostle that the text says was standing at the feet of Jesus on the cross? John. He's a friend to Jesus. The friend who was going nowhere even when his Lord was being crucified in front of him. And the question is, of all the people that you could ever be friends with, you know Jesus is the one that is the very best friend you could have. Would you be the kind of friend that no matter what else happens in the course of your life, you're standing with Jesus? Let's stand together and be the kinds of friends that will help each other have a stronger, closer relationship to God and get closer and be better people, get closer and be better and go to heaven and all get to go together. Appreciate it. Glad you were here.